Welcome back, everybody.
Welcome back.
Start this?
Is that yeah, how we start this? Welcome back is pretty good because it's like, hey, man, I mean, there's
you
people
could just
still
be
listening
to right. You could be listening to us first or right after the first episode, but just for anybody listening to this, we haven't recorded this episode since, or we haven't recorded a episode of At the Cinema since July.
July,
something like that.
Yeah, my birthday. We went to Six Flags and then we did this. So this was,
July. I mean, we're recording this over halfway past September now. So that should give people an idea of how long it's been. This is just what quarantine does to, especially when we're dealing with amateur podcasters. That's just what's going on.
I mean, it's a lot has happened in the 2 month period of July and September. Not a lot has changed, but there's still a lot that's happening, I guess. Like
there's a ton of what's happening, and
we're still,
as you
can
probably
dealing,
tell,
yeah,
is that this is a totally different audio quality and format from the last episode because we are recording this remotely due to everything that's going on. But hopefully we'll be able to get through this as best we can, because this is our lust episode for At the Cinema.
Yeah, this is lust. This is a lust episode. Man, wish I could be lustful right now during COVID, but we're still dealing with it.
I think a lot of people can relate to that. But yeah, we decided to go right into the Sin of Lust right after our Greed episode, which I think turned out pretty well. And we'll get to that in a second. But before we talk about the movies that we selected to represent the Sin of Lust, we're going to talk a little bit about things that we've been watching lately that has piqued our interest and just talk about that a little bit. So I'll let Nick discuss what he's been watching lately.
Yeah. So we forgot one thing to do is our glorious intro. This is Tea in the Butt.
Oh, yes. Special. This is Tea in the Butt. That's right. it's been that long since we've done an episode.
Yeah. Tea in the Butt. Soup special. I'm T.
You are T. See, we forget this every time.
You got it right.
The butt.
I got it right.
But we did get it right. We did get it right this time.
We did get it right. I've been practicing for 2 months.
And it paid out. All that practice has paid off.
So, this is T. I have been watching, and I think I've watched it 3 times now. And it only came out 2 weeks ago. I've been watching Raised by Wolves.
Oh, the HBO Max series.
Man, it's really incredible. Like, I don't even know where to begin with this show. So basically the plot of it is that there is a war between atheists and the Mithraic, who are religious people. And the atheists land first in this planet, I guess the Mithraic were trying to also inhabit.
Well, pretty much all of humanity's been like wiped out.
Yeah, the Mithraic has this arc.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like the Noah's Ark, but it's kind of like, you know, the Mithraic is like a very evolved version of Christianity and all these other religions combined. The Mithraic, they're believers. And I my theory of the film or the show so far, so you have every religion on Earth kind of like coming together versus people who are non-religious, who are the atheist. And there's this huge war on Earth between atheist and religious people. And I guess Mithraic probably down the line resolves and they're the best religion in that kind of like subcategory. And, you know, we're like, okay, this is the end times. We're going to build an ark and we're going to go find civilization on this planet that has, I guess, the most remote resources as Earth that they found in their solar system, or, you know, that's travelable because it takes 13 years I think to get there. But man, this show, like, there's so much to talk about. Like, I could talk about the show for hours.
Yeah, I've been keeping up with the show too. It is a lot to, I mean, we could probably do a whole episode just on this show because there's so much to delve into, and the series isn't even done yet. We've got several episodes to go. But it is spectacular show, just super well made. It's the best thing that Ridley Scott's done in a while.
I will agree. Cause he's been doing producing stuff, and then, you know, he did Prometheus, and then he did, Alien Covenant, and he's, you know, done a lot of great productions. You know, the 2049 Blade Runner. I think he produced Alita Battle Angel. Or no, that was James Cameron, right, that produced it.
That's right. It was Cameron and Rodriguez that did Battle Angel Alita.
Yeah.
But I think what makes this show special is because it's HBO Max specific, or exclusive is the word.
Yeah.
I think they were able to give Ridley Scott more creative freedom to do what he wants to do, more creative freedom of the show, because the show is just really well put together. Like, yeah, the special effects, the makeup and everything
are
amazing.
Yeah. So the special effects in the show, don't want to talk too much about it, but the special effects of the show really threw me off, and it felt like it was kind of like this hyper-realistic TV Aeon Flux.
Yeah, I get that, like, feeling too.
Yeah, it has this really cool design artwork with it, and like the styles of the spacecrafts. But the androids, their suits are like these like really weird material that makes the suits look like it's CGI, but it's their suits that they're just walking. And so it has this really cool robotic feel to it as well. It definitely, like, I don't know, man, the show plays out really well. Like, it's definitely a sleeper show.
Yeah, and it's called Raised by Wolves because it's essentially about these two androids who try to raise children on an alien planet similar to Earth as a way of restarting mankind from the slate board, so to speak. Yeah.
And the androids also don't believe in religion. They're atheists, and so they are raising these children with no religion, so Raised by Wolves is like this great title. It's great. It's a great show.
Yeah. I definitely recommend it if you guys, well, obviously you'd have to get HBO Max to see it, but I'd say it's worth it.
It is definitely worth it. That's just, you know, we just talked about the android part. There's this whole other part of like infiltration with this, you know, religious group. It's good. There's a lot. Yeah,
I said, we could probably do a whole episode just on this show, but
yeah,
that should probably be saved for when the whole series is finally out and we've been able to see everything, because I still have so many questions about what the hell is going on.
Same. That's it. Yeah, that's the end of the what I have been watching recently. I wanted to talk about another show, but that took a lot of time. So
I just briefly wanted to say the one thing that I've been watching lately has been this documentary film that came out. I saw it on Amazon Prime streaming, but it's available on several other platforms, called Feels Good Man. And it's the documentary about Pepe the Frog and about how he had been kind of hijacked by the internet alt-right into a hate symbol. And it's about the artist that created Pepe the Frog, who's this just stoner goofball named Matt Fury, who makes tremendous artwork, tremendous psychedelic artwork. And he created this character from a comic book he wrote back in the mid-2000s that he put on MySpace. And next thing you know, 4chan co-opts it as pretty much their mascot. And then next thing you know, it's representing like incel activities and like misogynist undertones. And then next thing you know, you start seeing it being used for racist and xenophobic and otherwise bigoted purposes. And
yeah, it's the devalue of the meme. It's like this trickle down meme economics of a documentary series, right?
I mean, what's really bizarre about it is, you know, there was a movie I saw earlier this year as part of the South by Southwest Film Festival that they kind of did on Amazon Prime, and there was a documentary that they showed on there called That Feel When No Girlfriend.
Yeah,
and
you told me about this.
But that movie wasn't so much about the meme. Like, they literally say about 45 minutes into that film that there's no way you can make a full-length movie about the That Feel When No GF meme. But in this movie, it's because the center subject of the film is Pepe the Frog. His story and the culture surrounds him is so massive that you can fill out an hour and a half long full-length feature film just about Pepe the Frog. They even talked to certain experts in the occult and magic about the mystical I'm not even kidding, the mystical properties of
Pepe the Frog. No way.
And it is cool. It is super cool to learn about.
So this is a meme that has mystical properties.
Yeah. And then they show that right after they show this guy who pulls up playing the Pokemon theme song out of a Lamborghini, and saying how he owns the rarest Pepe in the world. And you're and you're supposed to take this like seriously, like this isn't a joke.
This is like old Pepe, having old Pepe in your artwork could be, I have the oldest meme, because Pepe was a very early meme. Like it was one of the first memes, right?
It was definitely one of the earliest ones. I mean, it was being used even before 4chan kind of took off with it, but it was definitely one of the more popular image board memes for sure.
And if no one knows what we're talking about meme wise, this is because they might not have seen it.
Most likely they know what we're talking about because
most likely, but they might never seen it because it's you know, it's now, you know, with incels and
Well, I think one point that they made in the film is that it's trying to regain a good reputation. So there are parts of the movie that are really funny. There are parts of the movie that are very sad. There are parts of the movie that are moving when they talk about the career as a children's book illustrator that Matt Fury's trying to get going now. And then there are also parts of the movie that are just downright terrifying.
And what is this? So what? So it's a docuseries, right? It's not a movie.
Yeah, it's a documentary.
Yeah. What's it called again? It's called
Feels Good Man.
Which Feels Good Man.
The very first incarnation of the Pepe meme was him saying Feels Good Man. So that's why the whole movie's centered around just that one, because it comes from one panel of one comic.
That's the oldest art. That's the first.
Yeah, it came from, you know, the first panel is somebody walks into the bathroom and sees Pepe going pee-pee, and his pants are pulled all the way down. And then in the next panel, they're like, do you always pull your pants all the way down to go pee? And he just says, feels good, man.
Yeah.
And that's sure just does. It's been a revolution.
It has. So kind of dissecting where memes come from is a very interesting topic too. Because that meme came from a comic book that probably no one ever saw but this one guy. And he was like, cool. And now it's this attraction throughout the inner space highway of the internet. You know, and that's crazy because there's a lot of memes out there. You know, there's like Anakin Skywalker memes.
Oh yeah, they've talked about all sorts of memes. I mean, even the Rick Astley music video is a meme, or Dawson crying at Dawson's Creek, or Nyan Cat, or any of these.
And a lot of people probably don't know where that actual photo of the original shot came from. And so that's really cool dissecting a meme, and that's a really good, cool idea for a documentary.
But I think it's the only meme that's actually come into our tangible reality, because I think they wouldn't have made the documentary if it weren't a huge part of the 2016 presidential election, which it did.
Really? It did?
I highly recommend people.
That sounds good.
Yeah,
that
it's good. Really good. I've Feels seen it good, three man. Times since I bought it 2 weeks ago.
It's on Amazon?
It's on Amazon, but I think you can buy it on Apple TV and Vimeo and a couple of other streaming services. But the most popular one you can watch it on is Amazon Prime.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. That sounds really interesting. I've never thought of a documentary that was going to cover a topic so in-depthly of a meme.
I really love it. There's a lot of great animation in it that was done by Matt Fury. I loved how they just kind of stuck with Matt as far as the creative side of things and how it's trying to tell his story as opposed to the story of Pepe.
Yeah, the story of the meme, you know, like it's actually focused on the artist.
Because the artist didn't even know what a meme was, and it's about his discovery of what memes are capable of. But that aside, I think we should get into the program and start talking about the Cinema Lust.
You know, that's okay. We can do that.
I'm lusting to talk about these movies that we picked. Before we even mention either of the films, there's something we need to get out of the way very clearly to anybody listening to this podcast. From this point onward, we're going to be discussing some very serious adult content. And if anything along those lines make you uncomfortable or triggering to you, this is your only warning you're going to get that beyond this point, there could be content that some people listening to this may find disturbing. And so if you feel like skipping this episode, we won't fault you for it, but we just want to put this out there first and foremost before we go into mentioning what our movies are. So Nick, why don't you just say a little bit about Crash?
So I picked David Cronenberg's Crash. I wanted to cover this, you know, topic of lust by picking something, one, that I haven't seen in a while that I thought represented the film pretty well. And two, that was controversial. I didn't want to get too controversial. I didn't want to, you know, I think my very first pick for it was Antichrist by Lars von Trier. And that's a very controversial film. It's a good one, but it's a very controversial film on kind of being, you know, anti-feminist,
certainly
being very exploitive.
Well, it's definitely very graphic, but
yeah, so Crash. Yeah. And so, yeah, so I picked Crash because it came out, God, more than 10 years before. Yeah.
96. It's been,
yeah, it came out 10 years before Antichrist. Yes. And it got a lot of buzz for it being this film. It was banned in a lot of places. So it's a very controversial film at the time. And I have a theory about why it was controversial. But before I talk about theories, I'm going to kind of explain.
Yeah, but well, before I let you continue, I just want to point out that this is not the 2004 Crash. 2004
Crash. I say.
So if anyone's listening to this that's only seen the Matt Dillon Crash and is very confused about what we're talking about, we're not talking about that movie. There's another movie by David Cronenberg called Crash that came out in 1996. This is the movie that we're going to be discussing. I just want to point that out because I know that.
Yeah, I know. No, that's why I credit it as David Cronenberg's Crash, because if I just said Crash, people would be like, you mean that like film about racial and
you can't say that anymore.
You mean that film about racial injustice? And I'm like, wait, what fucking film about racial injustice? No one said Crash was a film about that. Like, but it won all these awards. So it's kind of pinpointed as this. Yeah.
It won best picture. That's why we have to make this explanation.
Let me remind people, David Cronenberg's Crash did not win Best Picture. Crash from 2004 did.
The 2004 Crash won Best Picture.
I want to pick it because it's very controversial. It came out, you know, it's still controversial, which is weird because it came out 15 years before Antichrist. And I was like, you know what? Why is this film controversial? And I have theories on why it's controversial, but I'll talk a little bit about kind of the plot very quickly. The plot is very simple.
It's very thin.
Yeah, it's a very thin fucking plot. Like, there is not a lot to really talk about the plot of this film.
No.
So there is a couple, the Ballards, who, you know, infiltrate an underground society of individuals who find sexual stimulation by like automobile accidents, right?
Right.
And the way that James Ballard, played by James Spader, is kind of like introduced into this world is he gets into a car wreck and sees opposite of him.
An accident. It was an accident.
Yeah, it was total accident. But I mean,
because later they do intentionally get into car wrecks.
Right, right. So James Spader's part was the accident part, right?
Right. This part of the film, somebody, once he gets into a head-on collision with another car, the driver of that car flies headfirst into his windshield, through both windshields, actually, and pretty much dies on impact. But James Spader's character survives, and then he looks into the other car, and he sees Holly Hunter's character sitting in the car.
Yeah.
And then he notices that she begins to touch herself.
Yeah, she starts to kind of like, you know, like she does this weird move, and then like the seatbelt unbuttons her shirt, and like you can see like her right breast, and James Spader is just looking at it. And like the precursor, like the little pre-information about James Spader's character and his wife Catherine, who's played by Deborah Kerr Unger, is that they are both in this, you know, polyamorous relationship where they can have sex with whoever they want. But they're married, or you know, whatever. They're married. Yeah, they're married. They're introduced as the Ballards. Yeah.
But you can tell their relationships kind of that they're swingers.
Yeah, the relationship.
It's almost implied that their marriage is kind of on the rocks.
Yeah, it's almost like they're trying to find that one high they got during some kind of intercourse that they had together with other people, right?
Well, they were trying to. They're basically trying to find more exciting, risque and taboo things to do with other people to keep their own marriage alive, because you only really see them get intimate as a couple midway through the film. But right off of the first thing you notice in the film is you see James Ballard's wife cheating on him with another man, And then the next scene is you see James Ballard cheating on his wife with another woman.
Right. Right.
It, so you can tell that, you know.
But the thing is, though, is that, like,
this it
is.
It can be implied that the relationship's troubled, but it can also be implied that
so
it's
I think,
not.
Yeah. I think, either. I don't know, man. That takes place, like, later in the film when they've all kind of, like, when the Ballards have infiltrated this underground. Prior to that, they were kind of just having these sexual relations and talking about it, and it's being like they're trying to find this new high, and that's why I picked it for lust. Like, they're trying to find this new sexual release, or just their existential release, right? Throughout the film, and you know, it's pretty quick whenever we're introduced into the underground, and the underground is with people who get into automobile accidents for the pure rush of sexual fulfillment. I wouldn't say existential fulfillment, because right after it, they are so turned on that they have to fuck.
Well, I think what makes this movie still bizarre even to this day is it presents its audience with a fetish that no sane human being
yeah.
would ever have.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's a really good point.
Because pretty much everybody has been affected by either someone who's a friend of theirs or a family member, or them themselves have been involved in a car accident. And that is, like, not even close to the best time to get a boner.
You know, it's not a good time to get a boner. I don't think people who are in car accidents even remember, like, what actually happened.
Yeah, they're just, and not to mention the bodily damage you can suffer from a car collision is so shocking. But I just want to point out one thing, because we keep mentioning the Ballards and James Ballard. That's actually the name of the author of the book that this is based off of. So it was fascinating. And I'm also familiar with other things that J.G. Ballard, the author, has written, because there was a movie made several years ago called High Rise with Tom Hiddleston that I found to be completely fascinating. Yeah. That was also based on a J.G. Ballard novel.
Yeah.
But this is totally different. It takes the fetishization of our material world to a completely other dimension.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I think it does that through this kind of, like, subversive kink.
I would definitely say it's a kink, and it's definitely subversive.
And it's a kink that, yeah, like you said, I know a lot about kink and BDSM culture, and this, honestly, I've never fucking heard of. I assume that it kind of exists now, maybe. That's why this film is controversial.
Right, because especially in America, where we have these puritanical origins for our sexuality, and to even have the concept that people receive sexual arousement for participating in or observing car collisions, it does incorporate this kind of foreign element of extreme violence into eroticism, and I can totally understand why that makes people uncomfortable, because there's such a massive contrast between the two.
It is, but I also think it's, you know, it's not that uncomfortable for a lot of Americans, like over a million fans of NASCAR, who kind of get that excitement off of car crashes. And it's very kind of, I don't know, man. It's good. It's a really cool.
Well, I think you were onto something there, where you were explaining about how people get excited just with the anticipation of seeing a car crash or a car collision, because you can never truly predict when that's going to happen. Because nobody, unless you're going to a car derby, you're not going to know exactly when it's going to happen.
Right.
And you know that it is such a violent event that it can be thrilling, but to have something like that reach levels of erotic pleasure, I think that is the kind of fascinating thing about it. Now, beyond that point, there isn't a whole lot of plot left in the movie.
But there is, though, because, like, we just brought up the whole idea of kind of like a person being very aroused by car wrecks.
Right, and that would probably be Elias Codius's character, who's probably the most excited.
Yeah. Elias Codius plays Bob Vaughn, who is an ex-stuntman and does these, you know, historic car wrecks that killed individuals like James Dean. He, like, puts on the show. We don't get a lot about the character, but he puts on, you know, shows for people that takes the exact vehicles that celebrities died in and recreates their crashes, and that's, you know, the first thing we see is him, you know, recreating this James Dean crash, and the one that killed James Dean, right?
So before we're introduced to his character, he's kind of introduced as a medical photographer,
right,
at the hospital, right, when James Ballard and Holly Hunter's character, whose name is Dr. Helen Remington, they meet each other again at the hospital during their physical recovery, where I believe James Spader has to have pins put into his leg,
yep,
and she is hobbling around on a crutch, and he sees Elias Koteas's character visit Holly Hunter in the hospital to take photographs. Yeah. But we later discover that this guy is not a medical professional. In fact, they don't really go too far into his background.
Yeah, they don't. They don't at all.
He's an underground figure who is deeply erotically obsessed with car crashes, but particularly with, like Nick was talking about, with celebrity car crashes. The most detailed being the James Dean car crash that we see recreated in the movie,
right,
using the actual automobiles that were involved in the car crash, and is done to such painstaking detail that it's almost like, It's bizarre to watch, because you do see that there are a crowd of people on rafters about to witness this.
Yeah, it's kind of like a fucking high school football game, right?
Right, and this has been organized with other people, and they give the impression that it's a controlled event, to where they have two stunt drivers involved in the accident, but they were going to really crash into each other,
yeah,
and not have any safety equipment on.
It was done the exact same way it would have been how James Dean would have died.
And Koteas's character is actually in the Porsche,
yeah,
that they use in the crash. Now, I thought the specific model was fascinating, because they really do get into the make and models of the cars involved in these wrecks, which I thought was an extra interesting edge to this fetish they have. It's not so much the act of the car crashing, even though I think that is the biggest part, because that's almost like the climax of their fetish. But when they get particular about the make and model of the car, what parts of the car are, even Cody's gets tattoos of certain, like the steering wheel on his chest and the Lincoln icon. And I thought that that sort of symbology used in the film was interesting as well. Of course, they probably couldn't do a whole lot of that, because I wouldn't think any car company would want to have their brand in a movie like this.
Yeah, they're vintage vehicles. He talks about the engine and everything. So yeah, like the car branding, I guess that they kind of had some free flow on it, maybe because they were older vehicles.
They do use a lot of vintage vehicles, which I thought was just outstanding in the film. But it also concerned me, because I think I was reading that they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars just on getting six copies of one model.
The one that Bob Vaughn drove, that really old, shitty, like Oldsmobile.
Yeah, that's right. It was an Oldsmobile. They said that they had six of them, and they converted one of them into a filming vehicle.
Yeah, so one was a filming vehicle. The other five were because it got wrecked so much, because they were doing all these weird, they were doing a lot of stunts. There was like a high, the end of the film, like, is kind of like this high speed chase between the Ballards and Bob Vaughn, and it's kind of like, I don't know. I honestly think, like, the way to describe this film is very, very many climaxes with a climax that plateaus, because the film just kind of ends, right? But in between, it's a lot of climaxes, not just sexually, but there are just all these climaxes in general.
Yeah, I mean, it ends in the same way a porno movie ends, where there's not nothing gets resolved. It's just like, hey, oh, you saw, God, what you came, man, here to see,
yeah,
and there you go.
Yeah, that's. I didn't think about that, but yeah.
But I'm not doing the movie as good of a service as it deserves, because it does have certain complexities to
you
it.
Make
like,
it sound like the script is just like, do you want to come in my car? And I was like, yeah, I'll come in your car. Crash the movie.
It is a little more intricate than that, because there are certain scenes that are very, very interesting. One thing I wanted to say that also makes the movie controversial, which I'm sure played into the overall controversy of Crash when it came out, was the fact that it deals with lesbian and gay sex in relation to the fetish as well. And I think that that in the mid 90s probably rubbed people the wrong way, because those times were not nearly as woke as they are now, where it's a little more acceptable to see two men make out on camera or two women having sex on camera. It's not as big of a deal. But in the context, even in this movie, you still have scars being shown. You see wounds being played with. And these things are still very taboo, even by today's standards.
The homoeroticism in the film, I think, you know, kind of stands out. It was made in, you know, 96, 98 was when it came out. Because I think it came out in 96, and then, like, it got released in the States at 98 because it...
Yeah, what I have is it was filmed in 96, and then it had a delayed release, and it didn't come out until 97. Which is Ted Turner's fault, but we'll get into
that. There's a lot of things to touch on, like the timing of the film. You know, the mid-90s, sure, there was a lot, you know, of it was, you know, definitely post-AIDS. A lot of, like, the homo intercourse scenes, I guess, were probably seen. I guess, you know, this film came out.
And what we're referring to here is there is a homosexual romance that starts between Vaughn and James
Ballard. Yeah, and it's not, you know,
it doesn't start off that way, but the more that they begin to be around each other and they begin to share sexual partners with each other, and how Vaughn will use Ballard as his chauffeur while he has these sexual rendezvous, and how he's involved in one way or another, they all become intimately involved, including Vaughn, Ballard, his wife, Dr. Remington, and the stunt driver.
Yeah.
Oh, and of course, Roseanne Arquette's character. We can't leave her out.
Yeah.
Her character is really fascinating, because even though she doesn't have a whole lot of screen time, she seems to be even more obsessed with this fetish than Vaughn is, in my opinion, because she kind of... I think
the reason that, like, she might be a little bit more obsessed with it is because she didn't recover from an accident. Like, she has this gaping scar that's, like, kind of, like, you know, plays on the body horse. She's in a leg brace.
I think one of her legs is in a leg brace. I believe that leg has this massive gash that she received through a car accident. She's also missing one of her breasts, and she has to wear this, like, prosthetic, almost like a holster that makes it seem like she has two breasts.
Her character is very interesting, because I feel like she has gone further than Bob Vaughn has.
Well, ultimately, Vaughn does go even further, but...
He does, but, like, we really don't know about Roseanne Arquette's character.
We don't.
She's kind of, like, the side character, right? That, like, it's... Like, in, like, a Lynch film, you're like, what the fuck is this here for? And she's like,
she seems to be, like, Vaughn's first disciple. She was the first person who made the connection in her mind between eroticism and this car accident.
Right.
Maybe because the car accident at first was so horrific and depressing to her that she needed to reframe the situation so desperately that she was willing to team up with Vaughn and follow this dangerous sexual exploit.
Good character. I mean, this film, like, I don't know, I honestly didn't think we would go this in depth with this film, because I figured there wasn't that much to talk about. But now that we're actually talking about it, that's the thing I like about Cronenberg films. And I want to, like, point out, so Cronenberg, before this, he made, you know, body horror film. He's like the godfather of body horror.
He is, yeah. Because before this, I think he just did The Fly, was his big one.
So, no, Naked Lunch was before this.
Naked Lunch, that's right, which was after
Scanners The Fly. Was before this.
Yes.
The Fly.
Rabid.
Videodrome. But
that was his first film.
Videodrome, which was kind of like the body horror cinematic, you know. This was kind of like bringing the sci-fi epic with body horror, right? And I mean, like, people think about body horror, they think before Cronenberg, they think about The Thing, which is a very good explanation of body horror. It's kind of like mutation of oneself into something else. But before then, The Thing was based on, like, an alien invasion that was, you know, changing and manipulating people, but it wasn't yourself. Body horror, what Cronenberg did to body horror was it was yourself that was changing, that you had to deal with, rather than, oh, it's, you know, an alien invasion and something else outside that's kind of like making this change. Cronenberg dealt with it that it was yourself changing.
Yeah, this movie definitely doesn't have a science fiction edge to it.
Yeah, it doesn't, like, have the body horror. There's one scene that is, I guess, body horror, and that's whenever James Ballard, James Spader's character, fuck Glenna.
Yeah, he has sex with Roseanne Arquette's character.
And he puts his either fingers
by on far the most controversial sex scene in the movie, which there are several.
Yeah, but he puts his penis or his finger in the this huge gash that she has on her leg.
He treats it like her other vagina is essentially what
happens. So he's turned on by this very, people would see it as this very ugly addition to a person. He views it as kind of like another sexual organ. It's kind of like this beautiful thing. It's weird.
And here's the thing that's really, because that is a very skin crawling moment of the film, but I think that's what kind of makes most audiences confused, because again, no sane person would look at that and find some sort of sexual arousal.
Yeah, sexual attraction.
From something right. that hideous and just horrific to for most people. And to have this seemingly normal human being get so stimulated just by touching and doing what he did to this wound, I can definitely see why people walked out of the Cannes Film Festival, even though it received the special jury prize.
Yeah, it did. Did and so it received the special jury prize, and Francis Ford Coppola refused to fucking hand it over.
That's right.
He was so appalled. Even though
he was responsible for giving it the special jury prize, I think he did it because he understood the artistic merit behind the film, despite many people getting outraged by it at the festival.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't think his personal moral guidelines would allow him to say, like, yeah, I didn't like the film.
Yeah, which, on his part, like, I would say, like, it was really shitty, Coppola doing that, because Coppola has made True. Some very incredible films prior to this. This is 97 or 98, I think, when the award was actually given. But, like, honestly, man, like, you did Apocalypse Now, you did, The Godfather, you did The Conversation.
He did Bram Stoker's Dracula, which also had its own erotic edge to it as well.
That came out after or before?
No, much, much earlier. I think it was 91 or 92.
Really?
When Dracula came out.
Because Dracula was homoerotic as fuck.
It was very, yes. It was also kind of a commentary on Victorian sexuality as well.
I mean, the story of Dracula, the idea of vampirism is homoerotic just in general. And for you to make a Dracula film and then say that this is, a Dracula film that won Best Picture too. It won a lot of awards in the academies, didn't it?
I don't know if it won any like acting awards, but
it definitely got nods for Academy. Whereas like Crash didn't get any fucking nods,
Yeah, which by the way, Crash did not get any nods outside of the Cannes Film
Festival. It was just that, So okay, I want to kind of wrap up. I know we've been talking about this for a little bit. I have a theory about the film and why it was so controversial. So it came out, between 96 and 98, depending on where you are in the world. This was it came out between 96 and 98, and this is the golden age of VHS, right? People can afford to see VHS films in their home. Pornography film is so rampant in people's homes now because you can actually, you don't have to go to a theater to see pornography. You can go to a shop, buy a VHS tape with your VHS player, and watch it at home. So I think the controversy with this is that it was so sexual that people thought it was going to be a pornographic film with an actual plot. Whereas like pornographic films at that time didn't have plots. They were just sex scenes. And so I think that was a huge kind of adversive. And there, VHS is very cheap to make. It's very cheap to sell. I feel like that's kind of like why it was so controversial. It's like, do we let the mass stream of people who can afford this format now see this film? Yeah, I think they should, because there has been TV shows that are far more controversial, I think, now. We can watch on Netflix and HBO. Whereas this, now, back then, it was just so controversial because I think porn was being more rampant in homes. This was before the internet, but it was still affordable to see pornography in homes. And this is going to be a film that's going to be rented at Blockbuster.
True. And I also think that this was kind of almost the final nail in the coffin as far as erotic thrillers are concerned, because I know that they were becoming more popular in the late 80s into the 90s with films like Body Double and
talk about Body Double, the Palma film.
Body Heat as well is another one. A lot of films by, I can't remember his dang name, the guy that did Scarface.
Brian De Palma did a lot of very exploitive films that revolved around the idea of sexuality and kind of like a theories of sexuality, but wasn't very graphic in the sexual sense.
And I think this film was almost a commentary on those genres of film, because it was using the same formula as an erotic thriller. But as you mentioned, the subject matter was too subversive for most audiences. It was almost like the movie wanted to challenge people's expectations on sexuality, wanted to be subversive from the get-go.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a film that people should check out if they want to kind of dive into the sin of lust and kind of see a very subversive, controversial film, especially if they haven't seen a Cronenberg film. It's not really the best start for a Cronenberg film. I would definitely suggest Scanners, Videodrome, The Fly, or Dead Ringers over this film for a Cronenberg film introduction. But it definitely, if you have seen a Cronenberg film and you have not watched this film, it's very hard to find, as Harlan knows. But the Criterion is releasing it in December on a 4K restoration.
This December?
This December. The Criterion, okay. Which is, you know, they produce films.
Well, they're almost like a film preservation society.
They are
at
a
this
film preservation
point.
Society. And I think they're doing it because Crash is starting to kind of get in that aspect of there's not releases coming out in this film. The media that has preserved this film is starting to die off. And so I think they're doing it because Criterion can actually kind of own all of the originals of the film, and they can actually preserve it in their vaults, which is great. Criterion is, you know, probably one of the fucking greatest DVD, Blu-ray release companies.
And this isn't the first Cronenberg movie they've handled either. I know that I have the Criterion of Naked Lunch. Again, a very challenging movie, not just to watch, but just the filmmaking process behind it was
I mean, how do you make a William S. Burroughs film? Let's let Cronenberg do it.
Yeah, well, people said it couldn't be done. That even when they announced it, they were like, there's no way this can be done.
Cronenberg does a pretty good job at it as kind of making you feel lost and dysfunctional in a film. Naked Lunch does that. Kind of like I feel like William S. Burroughs' mind is. So, yeah, I mean, Cronenberg's great. You know, they've treated Scanners, The Brood, Videodrome.
Later Existence and Spider were later films that Cronenberg
did.
You're just talking about Criterion Collection?
Yeah, Dead Ringers was a very, very early Criterion release.
Dead Ringers. Oh, my God. We totally forgot about that
Yeah,
one.
Jeremy Irons playing twin gynecologist. It's a very weird film.
Another kind of vague body horror film, too.
Yeah, very vague body horror. Very vague. It doesn't take place in, like, kind of like the realm of Cronenberg, you know. Cronenberg, after this film, did Existence, which is a weird video game, Matrix, post-Matrix.
It had a little bit of body horror, too, but it was almost like Naked Lunch meets Johnny Mnemonic.
Yeah, Johnny Mnemonic.
I wouldn't even say The Matrix. Yeah, or Strangeland was another sci-fi film that was more similar to.
It doesn't take place in kind of like, you know, oh, the AI's control. It's more of kind of like an escapism film with body horror. But then after that, he did a couple mafia films. He did History of Violence, and then he also did Eastern Promises, which Eastern Promises is fantastic. But it's kind of, it's very weird for him to do something like that. No body horror involved at all. And then after that, he did A Dangerous Method.
Well, his offspring went on to make a movie several years ago. Was aware of that one movie with the guy from X-Men First Class, where it's about catching diseases that celebrities had.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
because it's not only about the obsession of celebrity culture, but it's also just about, it's almost similar to Crash, where it's just about these psychopaths who have a sexual fetish for getting sick.
And this is done by his son, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, so his son is kind of like following the
antiviral.
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 That he did Cosmopolis, Map to the Stars, both featured early Robert Pattinson, post Twilight. This is before Robert Pattinson is now the Batman.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he's worked around a lot of his films. He's Canadian. They all mostly take place in Toronto, or they're filmed in Toronto.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up. They filmed Crash.
But it kind of takes place in LA, right?
Yeah, it does take place in LA.
They filmed it all in Toronto.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, what I learned, is pretty much the filming location of all
Cronenberg's
films.
Toronto, yeah.
And the movie was filmed, what I picked up was filmed maybe like 5 miles outside of his apartment.
Yeah, so like a 5-mile radius of his apartment, that's where every scene was filmed.
So that's just so amazing that he convinced this major studio to do this for them, which was put up by Fine Line Pictures, which is owned by Time Warner, which at the time was chaired by Ted Turner, which I mentioned earlier, because the most interesting thing I picked up on this was Ted Turner was the owner of Fine Line Pictures, and he was the reason why the film had a delayed release until 97, even though it came out in 96, because he was personally objected to the film's content, and he was more concerned about people seeing the film and then trying to do these
things, right? Like, to like kind of do this fetish. It's like people are like, oh, this fetish exists? No, it doesn't fucking exist.
It doesn't. I get the paranoia behind, like, well, we don't want to have Americans like just getting like into car wrecks to see if it'll turn them on.
Yeah, see if it'll make them, you know, like get a boner.
But I don't think that's the message of the film at all. The message of the film is, if you get into a car wreck, you will want to have sex, or you will have sex if you get into a car wreck. The message is, these are some very damaged people
who've
been through a very traumatic event. And anytime you get into a car collision, it's a traumatic event.
It is. It is.
And it is about them kind of re-owning the experience in the only way they can see satisfying to them. And it's not right. Like, you can tell it doesn't align with most people's morals. But in a weird way, it still is a story of these people trying to liberate themselves from the trauma of being in a car accident. Because with car accidents, it's different than getting assaulted. Most of the time, it's not out of an act of malice. It is only out of a mistake.
That was made, right? Like, if it's wet outside.
Yeah, someone isn't looking, or someone loses control of the vehicle, that they're not deliberately done.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, and I want to... If you have anything else to say about the film?
Not really. I don't really much, because I mean, the movie, like I said, it's very thin as far as like the events that happen in the film. There's not really a whole lot to talk about, but conceptually I think we've said as much as we can say about Crash.
Yeah. And I think like what you just covered is very, very enveloped in this quote that I'm going to read from Roger Ebert. And this quote kind of like sums the film very well. And it kind of sums what you just talked about. So the quote is, quote, Crash is about characters entranced by a sexual fetish that, in fact, no one has. Cronenberg has made a movie that is pornographic in form, but not in result. Crash is like a porno movie made by a computer. It downloads gigabytes of information about sex. It discovers our love affair with cars, and it combines them in a mistaken algorithm. The result is challenging, courageous, and original. A dissection of the mechanics of pornography. I admired it, although I cannot say I liked it.
I think that he pretty much summed it up perfectly by writing that.
That is one of probably, I think, Ebert's best quotes, too. For a film like that, especially, he kind of knocked the whole idea of it, especially since it was a controversial film. He definitely gave it kind of a human approach to the idea of the film.
I guess to wrap this up, I think that Crash best represents the sin of lust by delving into what are some things that we wouldn't usually lust after, but from our base carnal desires, we are able to debase ourselves to the level to where we can find things as traumatic or as violent as car crashes to be sexually aroused.
Yeah, it's contrast and the dynamic, right? Like, you know, violence on one end, sexual pleasure on the other. These two meet in some forms of fetishism, right?
Well, yeah, cars are normally just fetishized as in perfect condition. When people fetishize against automobiles, it's mostly when the car is in perfect condition, where it's spotless, no dirt on it whatsoever, especially when you're talking about vintage cars or muscle cars or sports cars. That is an actual fetish that people have. Now, whether it's sexual or not, that's completely subjective to who you're talking about. The interesting part about bringing up the Roger Ebert review is that one of the things I watched in preparation for this episode was watching the Siskel and Ebert episode on Crash, because Gene Siskel's take on the film was very different. And he, like Ted Turner, was morally objected to the film. He didn't find any sort of artistic merit behind it. And if anything, he found the film to be just demoralizing and pretentious. Which I think saying that the movie's pretentious is a valid criticism.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this half of our podcast about Lust. We are going to continue talking about The Sin of Lust in part two, where we're going to be discussing the movie Splatter Naked Blood, so be sure to check that out. You can also email us at 7cinemasins@gmail.com. That's the number 7, cinemasins with a Z, spelled C-I-N-E-M-A-S-I-N-Z @gmail.com. You can always find us on Facebook as well under the Two Soup Special name. This is The Butt signing off, and we'll see you in part two of the podcast.